Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, now that Charlotte City Council has said yes to funding for Bank of America Stadium renovations to the tune of $650 million, what happens next? The Charlotte Knights, our minor league baseball team, is sold to New York-based Diamond Baseball Holdings. North Carolina's fiscal year ends on Sunday, but still no deal on the budget due to a disagreement over teacher and state employee pay raises. Runoff elections in South Carolina decide some winners and losers. We look at what that may mean for the general election there. First Lady Jill Biden comes to town to talk about the importance of character in this election. And Madalena Kojakari's mother has been declared a suspect 2 years after her daughter's disappearance. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News senior editor Eli Portillo. Nick Oxner joins us. He's WBTV's executive producer for investigations and their chief investigative reporter. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Welcome back to you all. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
To be here.
Last week, on a 7-3 vote, Charlotte City Council agreed to kick in $650 million for Bank of America Stadium renovations. It's one of the largest public expenditures in city history for a single project, and it guarantees that the Panthers and Charlotte FC will be in town for at least 15 years. Clearly, some preparations need to be made by the city to make sure the deal is solid, the dates are set for the money to be paid out for all these expenses. So what is the timetable, Mary? What happens next?
Yes, so the plan is for the Panthers to now head into the design phase and for that to last about a year, maybe even into 2026, with construction getting started in 2026 and running through 2029. The idea that a lot of this work won't be done all at once, but rather sort of spread out over those 3 years in order to not interfere with Panthers games, Charlotte FC games, and other events like concerts that are scheduled at the stadium.
But as far as we know, Eli, this is completely done. It's going to happen, and the city staff has a plan.
Yes, and several city council members tried to delay this, asking for more details, but it was passed, as you said, on a 7-3 vote. Dimple Ajmera asked whether they would have a chance to really revisit this when. Later down when they vote on the financing, and the city attorney said nope. And, so it's a done deal for all intents and purposes. But I think that you've seen a lack of city transparency about the whole process. And as much as the deal itself, that was what frustrated the council members who voted to delay it, was kind of the way it went down.
This is what fascinates me. The council members are elected officials. City staff are hired hands, and yet they seem to run the show, not just in this instance, but in many instances. And I guess it could be argued that they are the professionals, and these guys on council are amateur, camp counselors, for a better word. And it did seem rushed, and there did seem to be, if not a lack of transparency, but a certain amount of obfuscation. They wouldn't even let council members see the deal without coming to a secure location, and they couldn't remove the papers. Ryan, is this the way we do business all the time, or was it just this deal, and was this deal rushed, and if so, why?
I do think that this is how business goes down in city staff almost all the time. There was a lot of argument back and forth, or discussion, I should say, about whether this plan was really rushed, just because some of the folks were saying, well, we've been saying that this is going to be needed for over a year now, so this wasn't a surprise to anyone. But the argument here is that the actual deal, the actual plans for what the upgrades look like, the actual spending deal was only unveiled a couple months ago. So if you're to say, just to say like last year, oh, we're going to have to do this at some point, some sort of renovations, that doesn't really count as any sort of, details that anyone can look into. And like you said, even once they unveiled them, in Dimple Ajmera's major point that she made on Monday was that what you said as far as not being able to take the plans home and really take a deep look at them in our own private time. And what she said was, that's not me looking at the plans then, basically.
Nick, you are like the knight of the mirrors in Don Quixote. You're constantly looking into the deep, dark crevices of government. That's kind of your job. It's also Mary's job as the local government accountability reporter for The Observer. But is this, since you have so much experience in ferreting through the deep, dark recesses of government, is this how we're doing business now? Is it always the way we've done business?
For better and worse, it's certainly the way we've done business in Charlotte. It's not just the city of Charlotte, it's Mecklenburg County. It's the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education. And I'm not saying it's okay, but I'm saying that's become the standard practice where staff says, here's what you're going to do. And our elected officials mostly say, meh, okay. And even if they then say, well, I don't like this, they end up doing it anyways. And that is the government that we have, because it's the government that the people keep tolerating.
Eli, I know you want to talk about this, and I'm going to let you do it right now, but I also have a question, and that is this an argument for what has been spoken about in the past of having a full-time elected government as opposed to a bunch of part-time people?
I think you could certainly construe it like that. Council has also proposed things like having more dedicated staff to help them get through complicated documents and manage their schedules. But at the same time, we do have this council manager form of government where the manager is expected to be kind of the lead dog and the professional there. What really stood out to me, to go back to what Ryan said about this deal, was, yes, they started talking about this back in January 23, but there was really no public discussion of any alternatives to this structure. No one said, well, since, you know, the Panthers and David Tepper own the stadium, should we do a 50-50 split? If we think it's worth investing in, should we do a 50-50 split instead of a 75-25 split? Should we get more guarantees of how Tepper's going to spend his own money? Should we push for a longer tether for the team to remain here? There were no public discussions of any alternatives or modifications to the deal besides what was presented. It was presented, there was some grumbling about it, and, you know, 3 weeks later it passed. And the other thing that stood out is council did not make David Tepper come down and talk about it, which, you know, they certainly had the leverage to, but I think the Panthers, you know, they sent their team president, and you can make an argument that for an owner as involved in the business and sports operations as Tepper has been, I'm surprised that there was no public push to get him to come and publicly ask for and justify the money.
The other feline organization, the one that used to run Cats, also was never summoned to Charlotte City Council to talk about what was going on and how they were operating the bus and train system, and we saw what happened there. Mary, one of the things that has come up since this discussion about voting yes on this has been the actual deal itself. The remodeling does not include adding a dome. It does not even include putting a covering over the stands, because that would have made, we are told, the whole project cost prohibitive. But that doesn't seem to bother some of the members of council who voted for this, including Republican Tariq Bakari, who called the deal, quote, the best deal in the country over the past 15 years. But one day after that deal went through on council, Jacksonville, Florida's city council approved a deal with the Jaguars, a $1.4 billion investment in their stadium. And that led some reporters to call Bakari's comment into question, because for less money, Jacksonville is getting a stadium with a roof and a promise for the team to stay for another 30 years, not 15. Various reporters wrote about this, including The Observer's Joe Person. What are some of the differences, Mary, because you've done a deep dive? What are some of the differences in these two deals?
Yes, so I did do a deep dive comparing the two deals, and on the surface, they're similar, but there are, in fact, some differences. Our deal is for the city of Charlotte to put $650 million into Bank of America Stadium. The Jacksonville City Council approved putting $625 million into the Jaguars Stadium. However, the terms of Jacksonville's deal also include the city putting an additional $150 million into deferred maintenance over the next 2 years to get that stadium ready for renovations. So some additional costs they're taking on there. They are also expected to get their project done a little bit sooner, 2028 versus 2029. However, the Jaguars are going to have to move out of their stadium for a season, and they are getting a shade structure. They are getting a canopy similar to what was built on SoFi Stadium, the new build out in Los Angeles that's been open for a few years now. I talked to Councilmember Bakari to see if he stands by his claim that our deal is better than Jacksonville's. He told me he did. He said that he feels that even though they got a longer tether and a roof, we are still in a better position.
Yeah, Tariq Bakari has not only said that, but he's criticized some of the reporters who wrote about this and took issue with his statement. He called lazy approaches and hot takes designed to get clicks, is what he called them. And when the job is so important to making sure our community gets smarter rather than dumber after we read their stories. Pretty strong words. He also appeared on Good Morning BT on WBT Radio to explain why he continues to stand behind his analysis and, in fact, calls it 100% correct.
I take this role and my conservative principles very seriously. And a stadium deal, right, for taxpayers is not one of those natural ones. So I really had to go over and above to make sure I was doing my diligence. I was negotiating certain points. And by the time I got there to the end, I mean, a lot of work had gone into it, and I felt very confident. So when I made the statement, it is my opinion that this is the best stadium deal that has been done in the United States in 15 years. It was not hyperbole.
So if you just take a surface look at the terms of both deals, it appears that Jacksonville and the Jaguars are sharing the costs of the stadium 50-50. As opposed to Charlotte kicking in $650 million to Tepper Sports $150 million. But Bakari insists that when you take a long-term look at the two deals, ours is better. Mary, when you did that deep dive, did you come to the same conclusion?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. So as I mentioned, we are putting in more money, technically, $650 million versus $625 million. However, we are not having to kick in that $150 million that Jacksonville is for maintenance. In addition to the money...
But we are kicking in, what, $1 million a year for traffic control around the stadium?
Yes. It is also, I think, worth noting, and Tepper Sports will tell you, they are also putting, in addition to the money that they are putting into the stadium itself, they're also pledging to put at least $421 million into the stadium for maintenance, whereas Jacksonville is taking on $150 million for maintenance as a city. They're also still in negotiations to maybe put some more money into the area around the stadium, so there could be more expenses coming there. That being said, they have a 30-year lease. We got a 15-year non-relocation agreement. Now, the Jaguars can buy themselves out of that 30-year lease virtually any time, but for the first 14 years, they would have to pay back all of the money they just got, which is a substantial sum. And they are getting a shade structure, which we're not getting here in Charlotte, and which some people have raised questions about. So it's difficult to do an apples-to-apples comparison just because there are so many differences when you really dive below the surface.
So our deal is for 20 years, but they can buy themselves out of 5 years of that, which makes it 15. And in 13 years, we're going to have to go in and start negotiating on building a new stadium, for which money will also be asked of the city, etc. When you look at it that way, and I have 30 seconds, how do the two deals compare?
It's honestly difficult to do an apples-to-apples comparison just because the two agreements are very different in terms of how the leases work.
Eli, 20 seconds.
When the Panthers get ready to start renegotiating for a new stadium in 2037. That'll be right about when their tether runs out, so they'll be in position to negotiate at their moment of maximum leverage.
Yep, how about that? Timing is everything. When we come back, we'll talk about a few other things, including some transit plan changes and some elections that took place this week in South Carolina. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. It's the local news roundup. Eli Portillo, WFAE's senior editor in the newsroom, is with us, along with Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter for WBTV, Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Ryan Pitkin, the co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Ryan, also at Monday's City Council meeting, Sarah Hazel with the city's Office of Sustainability and Resilience made a presentation on the city's Strategic Energy Action Plan. What is that?
So yeah, this is just a sort of a broad comprehensive plan that the city put together years ago and has been implementing slowly in terms of just different sustainable energy plans that the city can implement in its buildings, in its fleet of city-owned vehicles, in things like that. So usually a lot of these presentations can get a little wonky and boring, but this one had a couple of interesting new projects that the city is introducing in terms of solarized Charlotte-Mecklenburg. That was new that they announced in terms of trying to reduce barriers to solar energy and actually fund direct solar installations on low and moderate income homes. They also announced their new Green Prints program that will launch on the corridors of opportunity and try to implement a lot of projects, programs, partnerships around things like air quality, pollution, tree canopy, urban cooling. So it seems like they're trying to really find some equity in the green energy space in the coming year or two. Years to come, but it seems like that was sort of the gist of the presentation on Monday.
And they launched this in 2018 with a goal of being on track by 2050. But on Monday night, Sarah Hazel told council that although this is merely an aspirational goal, they're on track to hit that goal of at least zero carbon projection from city-owned buildings by 2030. How are they doing that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, they've slowly just been rolling out different green energy sources in all of their city owned buildings. And apparently something that we never see is that it's actually been going not only on track, but quicker than on track. And we're now down to less than 20% of the energy used in city owned buildings is coming from carbon producing sources. So I'm not sure if that last 20% is going to get wiped out by 2030, but it's just one of those surprising announcements that they're actually above board and faster than on track on this.
A couple of weeks ago, the city announced an agreement to acquire Norfolk Southern's O-Line track for the Red Line commuter train to Davidson after years of on and off negotiating with Norfolk Southern. But to build it, they will need to hold a referendum for the sales tax increase necessary to pay for all of this. And permission for that has to come from the legislature. And there's a roadblock there because they believe that our transit plan focuses too much on rail and not enough on roads. However, recently, progress appears to have been made in talks with Raleigh that included a reworked Roads First transit plan, which reduces the amount of funding for transit from a transit sales tax that would go to rail. And that necessitated, evidently, the elimination of the Silver Line train to Matthews, which has made Matthews a little upset, and Mayor John Higdon has made his displeasure known. But this week, Mary, you report that developers remain optimistic about the growth potential in that region, whether it's on the tracks or whether it's a bus that goes to Matthews. How can that be, when we know that light rail has become almost more of a development vehicle than a transportation vehicle, if you look at the blue line at least, and by and large, people don't want to take the bus?
Yes. So when the questions came up about the Silver Line in the last week, one of the alternatives that came up was that rather than having light rail on the eastern side of the planned Silver Line running through East Charlotte into Matthews, we could have bus rapid transit. And this is something that this group of developers who held a panel here in Charlotte earlier this week were very much in favor of. They said that in their experience, having more public transit is good for development, that they as developers are eager to build new housing and new mixed-use developments where there is public transit because it saves them money when they don't have to spend as much building parking and parking structures. And they said that, you know, in their experience, bus rapid.
Is that realistic? Hold on for just a second. Is that realistic? If you're living in that part of the world, you're not downtown Charlotte, you're out in the suburbs, and if you've got to go anywhere, you have to get on board a vehicle, whether it's a car or a bus or a train. And if people don't want to take the bus and you don't provide them with parking, is your development going to be successful?
They say that's the way that the market is trending, that people want to ditch their cars and they want to, in their own words, get people out of their cars. And that they think that based on their experience in other parts of the country, bus rapid transit is an attractive option to do that. Saying that, in their experience, potential residents and shoppers are less interested in the mode of public transit and more interested in it being a pleasant experience, easy to navigate, and running on time.
Eli?
I don't buy that. Charlotte's bus ridership on its regular bus system has absolutely cratered over the past decade, down, roughly 70% at its low point. It's come back a little bit, but, if that is true, and if that idea holds water, then I would say, why are we building any light rail? Let's do bus rapid transit on the other part of the Silver Line. We've already got bus rapid transit up I-77, so why are we bothering with the Red Line? Why not just save a bunch of money and do bus rapid transit instead of rail, if that's true?
And if you're taking that transit to South Park from that area or to downtown, the buses are still on the roads unless you build dedicated lanes down Monroe Road or Independence Boulevard or perhaps Pineville Matthews Road to get anywhere. And if not everybody wants to ride the bus, they're going to be in their cars. That's going to increase congestion on the road that the bus has to use. Maybe it's just me, and I'm certainly not a transportation expert. It sometimes seems that Charlotte likes to push square pegs into round holes. Wishful thinking.
Yeah, I think, there is maybe some element of that because the city and transit folks really want to get this sales tax over the finish line. They really want to get something built. And I think that that idea definitely has merit. I will also say bus rapid transit does mean buses in their own lanes. So in theory, you'd be going faster. You can certainly make an argument for investing more in the bus system because the bus system has traditionally carried more people than the rail system in Charlotte. But I don't buy this argument that it's the same as trains and Matthews should be happy with it.
Mary.
I think Eli's making an excellent point. Just for some additional context, as part of this same panel, the group of developers also heard from the head of the Miami-Dade Department of Transportation, who talked about some bus rapid transit projects they've been doing down in the Miami area, sort of a comp, who reported positive results. One of the more national developers participating in the panel also talked about some projects up in the DC area, as well as Los Angeles. So not necessarily saying I buy their arguments either, but just pointing out that there are, Charlotte is not the only place in the country that's sort of toying around with this idea. Some other big cities are as well.
Yeah, plus, I would say just really quickly, to me, it kind of sounds like you wanted to buy a Lamborghini, but you can't afford a Lamborghini. So you look at a, Ford Focus and you're like, hey, it's still got four wheels. It'll still get me where I'm going.
That is a nice and reliable automobile, Eli.
Exactly.
You'll be happy with it.
I think Nick has one of the titles.
Mary, he means the Lambo.
as you report, and we've been talking about this based on your reporting and others, that developers are happy with bus as opposed to rail. What about people? Why do developers always get the headline here? We're paying the taxes for all of this.
Yeah, so when I reported on this initial potential change to the Silver Line a few weeks ago, I talked to Matthews Mayor John Higdon. He told me that he wanted to talk a little bit further down the road once the proposal was more formalized, once we had a better idea of what actually is or isn't happening. I also spoke with Greg Asciutto, the leader of the community group Charlotte East, who told me there is a lot of anger and concern in his community right now about all of this newfound uncertainty about the Silver Line. His community wants answers, and if they don't like the answer that they get, they are very much prepared to start organizing to push back to get what they do want.
Okay, stay tuned. In South Carolina, there were primary runoff elections on Tuesday, including races for the Republican nomination for the state's 3rd congressional district, where Pastor Mark Burns faced off against Lieutenant Colonel Sherry Biggs of the Air National Guard. What did voters decide there? Who will they face in November, etc.? Eli.
In the 3rd congressional district, that was,
yes,
Sherry Biggs. Yes, Sherry Biggs won there 51-49%. And, it was a close race, but I think given how rare runoffs are, it was probably expected.
Will she have a Democratic challenger in November, or is she a shoo-in?
You know, I think either way she's a shoo-in.
Okay.
I'll be honest, I haven't looked too closely at that besides the primary race. But yes, I believe there is a Democratic challenger, but I think she's going to Washington.
There was also a runoff in South Carolina in the York County Sheriff's race between Deputy Rock Hill Police Chief Michael Belk and retired Police Lieutenant Tony Breeden. I think you know the answer to this, Nick. Who won that contest? You don't know the answer. Okay.
Tony Breeden won that race. Again, he got 52% of the vote. Rock Hill Deputy Chief Michael Belk got 48%. So another close runoff. Just 600 votes separated them. So even though, you know, runoffs are typically low turnout, you know, that just shows you got to get out and vote.
And there is no Democratic challenger in that race. So come November, Tony Breeden will become the sheriff down there. Also,
yes.
State Senator Katarina Shealy. Shealy is the big name in South Carolina politics, I think, has been for a while. She is the longest-serving female state senator. She found herself in a primary runoff with attorney Carlisle Kennedy. She of Shealy opposed South Carolina's near-total abortion ban. What was the impact of that?
Well, Katarina Shealy, a household name down south of the border, lost her Republican primary runoff race. And both Shealy and the two other female state senators who also Republican joined her in opposing the near total abortion ban in South Carolina, all three of them have now lost their primaries. So I think one takeaway there is at least in deep red states like South Carolina, there is a big political cost to be paid by, you know, even female politicians who oppose very restrictive abortion policies.
North Carolina. Let's move on to our legislature. North Carolina's fiscal year ends on Sunday night at midnight, but there is no budget yet and probably will not be. Has this ever happened before?
There is a budget because the General Assembly passes the budget on a biannual basis. So it's a 2-year budget. The budget was passed last year. This this is what's known as the short session this year. And so this was for where lawmakers can come back together and tinker with things they did the year before. So they're already set to be pay raises, for instance, and they were arguing over whether or not they should increase the amount of pay raises for teachers that we're going to give and state employees that we're going to give. And so there is a budget, and actually the state has operated without any budget at all. As well, it can. It just continues at the previous spending levels. But yes, they failed to reach an agreement on the tinkering.
So the impasse is over the fact that the House wants to give more money to teachers and state employees than the original budget provides for. And the Senate wants to give not quite as much more as the House wants to give. If the impasse never comes to resolution, things just stay the way they are in the main budget, correct?
That's correct. And the adjournment resolutions in both chambers passed this week say that they're going to move into non-voting sessions, but they're basically the General Assembly is going to keep itself in session through the end of the year with the ability to come back in if they want. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that we reach an agreement, but it's also perfectly reasonable that to expect that they just won't do anything else and they'll just do a new budget next year.
Something else that went on up in Raleigh this week. At the moment, the governor gets to appoint a replacement when officials like the state treasurer or the attorney general don't finish their terms. And now Republicans in the state house want political parties to help fill vacancies in some of these statewide elected offices, not the governor, Republican Representative Kyle Hall of Stokes County.
I think that the voters of North Carolina also not only elect a person, but they also elect a political party to serve in that position. And so this would give the political party the opportunity to nominate three people, and the governor would have to pick one of the three people.
We elect political parties? If that's even remotely true, what does that say about where we are?
Well, I think this is of a piece with the moves you've seen to restrict the governor's appointment power in all kinds of boards and commissions. This is something that the legislature has been doing aggressively for the last few legislative sessions. There have been lawsuits filed by the governor against the legislature, the last two governors, I believe, over reducing these powers. And I think that you've seen a concerted move towards taking more of the North Carolina governor's already pretty limited power and investing it in state parties and the legislature. So
this is beginning to sound theme. Yeah, but it's beginning to sound very autocratic, as do many of the other moves that are being made by Republicans and Republican legislatures across the country. We already have a weak governor. They've been working very hard to make the governor's office, not the governor, Roy Cooper, but the governor's office, weaker still. Is this an attempt to thwart the will of the people? How many other people believe that we elect political parties?
Well,
to
we're
make
talking
appointments?
About a scenario in which the governor currently just picks whoever he wants. So yeah. It's not like we're circumventing democracy here. And ultimately,
we aren't?
We're all, because the governor would otherwise pick someone. Look, we're talking about a different brand of politics injected into what is already a political process in this particular case. Appointments to fill vacancies is you know exceedingly political.
So this would require, as I understand it, an amendment to the North Carolina Constitution, which could be put on the November ballot. Is it likely to happen that quickly? And if so, would people notice? Would they likely say yes or no to this?
I think the clock is ticking on putting things on a ballot. They've got one referendum on there, which we might talk about, but they're going to have to move quickly if they want to come back in session and get another one on there.
Okay, some updates on some long-running stories that we have been following and all news outlets have been following in this area, among other things. And the use of body cams when they're present and when they're not. In a couple of local examples when we come back. It's the Local News Roundup with Eli Portillo from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, and Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. There was bipartisan support in the state Senate once again as they approved a bill to legalize medical marijuana. This bill would allow the use of marijuana for people with cancer, ALS, and other illnesses, but also place more regulations on the sale of hemp and CBD products. The House it's going to face a more difficult path in the House. Is this likely to go down without an agreement as this session closes yet again?
It's not going to face any path because they're basically done. They basically have shut the gate to the path for the session on anything other than a budget, a veto override, or any other major last minute policy things.
So does this mean that if people are in favor of this in the legislature, they have to start all over again next session?
Correct. And we should point out that this is the third year in a row that the Senate has passed a bill legalizing medical marijuana in some form or fashion, and it's died in the House. At this point, I'm not sure what the Senate could do, and they've tried to tie it, as they did again, they've tried to tie, because it's a big priority of Senator Bill Rabin, who's a top lieutenant of Phil Berger's, Senate Republican leader, to legalize marijuana. And it, again, has bipartisan support of farmers across the state. But there's a conservative faction in the House that just will not let this come to a vote. And it's something's going to have to change. I don't know what that thing is, but it hasn't changed yet.
Nick, let me stick with you for a while, because in February, a 12-year-old boy died at Trails, Carolina, which is now a defunct wilderness camp in the state. This past Monday, they released the autopsy report. What were its findings?
The autopsy report found that 12-year-old boy died of asphyxia due to smothering and ruled the boy's death a homicide.
Yeah, he was made to sleep in what is known as a bivy sack. And the autopsy report reads, quote, he was placed into this compromised sleeping area by others and did not have the ability to reasonably remove himself from the situation with the alarm that secured the opening. There was an alarm that was set to go off if they were to try to get out, and evidently it didn't work. And it also says that standard protocol was not followed. You've been investigating this since it came to light in February with some difficulty in getting a lot of information. Even officials had difficulty in getting information initially. And the State Department of Health and Human Services shuttered the camp and revoked its license in May. Will anybody be held legally responsible for what has now been called a homicide?
That's what remains to be seen, Mike. We should note that the sheriff has said, the Transylvania County Sheriff who's investigating this case, has said for months that he was waiting on the autopsy to be finished before moving forward in the investigation. And Mike, let's just put a little bit of a fine point on this bivy sack, if we can. Specifically, the autopsy noted that counselors that day zipped the solid outer layer of this bivy sack all the way up because the mesh, you know, layer, which was supposed to be used to shut the boy in so he could breathe, the mesh layer was torn. So the boy was essentially closed completely in a weatherproof bag, so making it difficult to breathe, according to the autopsy. So that's what happened. The sheriff has said he's reviewing the autopsy results and will discuss with the prosecutor. That prosecutor is actually former Mecklenburg County DA Andrew Murray, former U.S. attorney, who's now the DA for the three-county district that includes Transylvania County. And Mike, a little bit of breaking news this morning. I heard back from a spokeswoman for Trails Carolina just after 8 a.m. this morning, who said that they don't have a comment on the autopsy.
Okay. By the way, it's been 5 months. Does it take autopsy reports that long normally to be released?
I would actually say this is fast.
Okay. There was also a development in the case of Madalena Kojikari, who disappeared nearly 2 years ago in Cornelius. Police there now call her mother, Diana Kojikari, a suspect in her disappearance. Why are they just now reaching that conclusion?
It's a little bit of a befuddling thing because they've now issued this new flyer that says she's a suspect in Madalena's disappearance, but my newsroom pressed police quite vigorously and repeatedly for what that meant, and they said she's not being accused of any more crime, she's just a suspect in her daughter's disappearance.
Well, she and her husband were both tried on failure to report the child's disappearance. She served her sentence and was released from jail. Her husband, the child's stepfather, was convicted and is serving a suspended sentence. No other new charges have been filed against either of them, yet she is now considered a suspect. Why is he not? And what, if anything, does this change?
I think this would be the first time we've affirmatively seen her referred to as a suspect. I think there's been some heavy implication against Christopher Palmiter, that's the stepfather, Diana Kojikari's husband. But this was the police affirmatively naming Diana Kojikari as a suspect. But again, it feels like a change without much of a material difference. I do think it stands to reason, and police won't answer why they're releasing this now or what it means or what is any different from, you know, before they announced this.
Back in March, Eli, CMPD officer Henry Chapman transported a man arrested on an outstanding warrant to the University City Division office. But when he arrived, the suspect told the other officers at the intake area that Officer Chapman had taken a roll of $100 bills from him, a total of $900, he alleged. The suspect told the officers that Officer Chapman hid that money inside the driver's side door pocket.
No cap, I'm not even going to touch it. It's blue hundreds right here. It's all the blue hundreds are right there behind that receipt. Thank you. All that's my money. He didn't have that.
This is your money?
Yes, I heard him crumble it up. Thank you.
That came from a police body cam recording that a judge ordered released. The officer accused of taking the money later tells fellow officers, "That's not my money." But they quickly arrest him and take his gun, during which he made this comment to arresting officers, which was also captured on their body cams.
I just want to apologize to everyone and say, man, one of these things, dude, And I'm sorry.
That was back in March. What else do we know about this case, Eli? What happened to Officer Henry Chapman?
Well, he resigned from CMPD the day after that incident and his arrest. He was charged with one count of embezzlement, and that is pending. He was also cited by police investigators internally for violating policies about his own body camera and treating suspects in custody.
And I want to point out, we didn't play the audio all the way through, but the arrest, when they take his gun away from him and talk to him before and after the comment we just heard, was extremely gentle, shall we say. Nick?
It's worth noting that we're only seeing this video, which is pretty vital transparency about the conduct or misconduct in this case of police, because a media outlet went to a court and asked the judge to order it released. Because remember, body camera video is secret in North Carolina. And we should also point out that we're not seeing it because CMPD went to court and asked the judge to release the video, which they could have done as well. And just a reminder, this video that's meant to ensure transparency so public can see things like this is secret in North Carolina.
So it also tells the story that in order to have body camera video, you have to have your body camera on you or turned on. And in the shooting at the home in East Charlotte back on April 29th, in which several federal and state officials and a CMPD officer were shot at, and in which four died, including Joshua Iyer from CMPD, CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings tweeted that he commended, quote, Judge Strickland's decision to deny the release of the body-worn camera footage because there is no compelling public interest to release the footage. But there was no body cam footage, allegedly, of that incident because no officers involved in the initial approach were wearing them. The federal marshals have been phasing in the use of body-worn devices. CMPD has a policy that requires their use. And one of the CMPD officers lost his life. Was he not wearing a camera? Was it not turned on? Was he violating policy?
So this was a federal task force. And so even the CMPD officers assigned to that initial task force that was there to execute that warrant don't wear body cameras. This has been a long-running string with the marshals. You recall there was a deadly shooting involving a suspect at a Citgo in Plaza Midwood a while back where we also don't have body camera video depicting what happened there. The effort to get video was from the responding police officers and their body cameras that does exist.
Yeah, after the shooting had already been going on for a while, as the new officers arrived, they had their body cameras turned on. Would they have gleaned anything? Would we know anything more about this incident had body cameras been on the four officers who approached the house to make the arrest?
Always stands to reason. I think the other side of that would be people will tell you body camera in any situation doesn't tell the full story. It tells you some vantage point. That being said, I think there are still a lot of questions about how four police officers died and four more were injured in this shooting. And even if it's not public, even if the video weren't publicly released, it stands to reason that investigators could have had a lot more information about the second by second happenings in the initial shootout.
Ryan, the Charlotte Knights were sold this week to Diamond Baseball Holdings. Was this unexpected?
No, the Knights have been up for sale for quite some time, at least a year, if not over that. It was owned by Bill Allen and Don Beaver since 1997. They did some great things, namely moving them back to Charlotte into Uptown. But it's definitely not a surprise as to who bought them. Diamond Baseball Holdings has been on a spending spree buying minor league teams. I think they own 36 or what is it, 34 now?
34.
So yeah, 34 now. So that's sort of their MO right now and what they've been doing. And I've done some looking into what they're about, and it's the concern coming into this because they've done all this purchasing in the last 3 years with that. Maybe they're looking to slash and burn, do some of the things that other private equity groups are, because Diamond Baseball Holdings is a subsidiary of Silver Lake Private Equity Group. But things appear at this point, I'm not usually one to lobby for these big mega corporations, but all of the all the teams that they've bought so far seem to continue to be run by the same management as they're going to do here at Charlotte Knights. Doesn't seem like they've been cutting staff or doing anything really negative. It seems like their MO is actually to bring entertainment to these parks. So we might be seeing more shows and concerts and non-sports affiliated events at Truist Park here in the coming years as they sort of roll out their agenda, I guess.
And the sale price, Eli, was not disclosed. Is that normal? Is that because this is a private sale? I mean, it's a private equity group. I mean, should we know the price?
Yeah, it was not disclosed, as you say. I think, you know, that is kind of par for the course. You know, real estate records are public, but not, you know, all private business transactions like that. For comparison, you know, they bought, I believe, the Sacramento River Cats a couple years ago for $90 million. So this is almost certainly more than that, given the, you know, the state of the stadium and the way prices have gone up for everything in the last few years. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was $100 million and change.
A mixed reaction this week to the Charlotte Hornets pick in the NBA draft. They chose 18-year-old Tijane Salon from France, the sixth pick in the draft. Why the mixed reaction? Ryan.
I think it's just the fact that not a lot of people know about this guy. He was playing in the French league, averaging only 9 points a game there. So, you know, you see I think people go to look at the video of the Crown Club fan support group's reactions after last year when the Brandon Miller reaction sort of went viral, and this year was not all that different. It wasn't as negative of a reaction, but it was kind of a stumped, like, huh? And you know, the guy is great defense, and I think that's why they picked him. It's where they need to fill some holes.
Tijane Salon told fans that he was eager to join the Hornets and work with one player in particular.
I will bring all my fire in the court and ready to play with some player like you say, the LaMelo Ball, some alley-oop. I'm ready, yeah, to jump and put the ball in the rim.
In case you missed it, he's looking forward to playing with LaMelo Ball. And Hornets Executive Vice President Jeff Peterson said the team has had its eye on the 6'9" forward for months, but did admit that he needs some development.
He's the youngest player in the draft, a ton of upside, great frame. I was fortunate I got to go to Europe a couple times this season to see him and spend some time with him. He's an amazing, amazing human being, and I know he's going to, you know, do everything in his control to maximize himself.
Round two was yesterday. We had the 42nd overall pick. How did that turn out? And I've stumped the panel.
You can tell how many of us were watching with bated
right.
breath.
I wonder what
it was.
We
KJ
were
Simpson was the pick, but I'm not sure.
I was going to say, I wonder what we were watching. A super heat wave has been blanketing much of the country in recent weeks. And on Thursday, we experienced the hottest day of, well, I think Wednesday, excuse me, we experienced the hottest day of the year so far, with heat indices approaching 100 plus degrees. And with those hot temperatures, Mecklenburg Emergency Medical Services has been responding to more heat-related calls. Temps might return to normal this weekend, but certainly more hot days are ahead this summer. And Dr. Chris Branner with Atrium Health says that means you need to know about ways to cool down and know that a throbbing head, confusion, and rapid pulse are signs of heat stroke.
If you're in an environment, you're noticing someone having those kind of exaggerated symptoms, you know, that's a reason to call 911 and start to get some immediate help and try to help cool that person down as quickly as possible.
I didn't know this, but evidently heat stroke is one of the most serious medical emergencies. And if you or someone you know is experiencing it, they should bypass urgent care and go directly to the emergency room. That's all the time we have. Eli Portillo from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.